No. It's a real pleasure to be here today, and I just want to take a minute to thank everyone, especially Hannah, Carol here, and Mary Beth as well, and also Alan Golding and John Gibson at the Commonwealth Center for Humanities and Society at the University of Louisville, and especially John Begley and Peter Morin for making this part of their Afloat series of lectures. And I think there's one more Afloat lecture coming up, so if you'd like more information about that programming, I'd be happy to speak to you afterwards as well. And it's basically a series of talks that kind of think about the history, culture, and life on the Ohio River in the past and the present. It's great to have this opportunity to talk about my own research and link it to the history of this region and the Ohio River in particular. And in my work, I examine the relationship between the history of Indian diplomacy and Native American literature of the 19th century. And when I'm talking about Indian diplomacy, I'm talking about the diplomatic relations between the United States and Indian nations, but also the diplomatic relations between Indian nations themselves as well. So in this talk, I'll be drawing on some research from my book, but I'll also make some new forays into the indigenous history of the Ohio River Valley. And in this talk, I'll be thinking about the Ohio River Valley in relationship to the Ohio country at large, but I'll focus mostly on some histories and narratives that connect to the river itself. But I'll begin by going back to a text that actually first sparked my interest in my book project 8 years ago. So I'll start right there. In his travelogue, American Notes for General Circulation, which was published in two volumes in 1842, Charles Dickens paused on an encounter on board the steamboat General Pike on the Ohio River going from Cincinnati to Louisville. By the time Dickens came to the United States, he was already something of a celebrity on both sides of the Atlantic. And his book was a highly anticipated account of his travels from January to June of 1842, which led him from Boston south to Richmond and west to St. Louis. In American Notes, Dickens does what many European travel writers before him had done in their accounts of the United States, to complain about the country. Throughout his book, Dickens expresses a deep-rooted sense of the dehumanizing influence of American institutions, and as a vehement opponent of slavery, he was embarrassed at the country's lagging behind in outlawing the institution. Of the United States Congress, he asked, "Did I see among them the intelligence and refinement, the true, honest, patriotic heart of America?" "Not really," was his answer. "It is the game of these men," he writes, "and of their profligate organs to make the strife of politics so fierce and brutal and so self-destructive of all self-respect and worthy men." Of course, any similarities between current politicians is purely coincidental. But many of his observations in American Notes are a more general critique of American attitudes and manners, based on the people he encountered. The objects of his scorn include the food that was served on board these steamboats, poor table manners, intrusive questions, and Americans' habits of spitting in public. You know who you are. And he lamented an American preoccupation with business affairs. On his way from Pittsburgh to Cincinnati, Dickens found that the men he met on board the steamboat Messenger all carried on with, quote, "a weary air of business and calculation." He wrote, "They could have been the melancholy ghosts of departed bookkeepers who had fallen dead at their desk. Undertakers on duty would be sprightly beside them." Dickens came to the conclusion that in the United States, the people are all alike. There is no diversity of character. They travel about on the same errands, say and do the same things in exactly the same manner, and follow in the same dull, cheerless round. So Dickens just sounds like a wonderful travel companion, right? But this monotony is broken when Dickens recounts his travels from Cincinnati to Louisville on board the steamboat General Pike, when he meets someone who stands out to him from what he calls the usual dreary crowd of passengers. Dickens recounts how he received a business card from the Choctaw diplomat Peter Pitchlin, and how the two men had the pleasure of a long conversation on board the steamboat. In what follows, he describes Pitchlin as a physically striking person. He was a remarkably handsome man, Dickens writes. Some years past 40, I should judge, with long black hair, broad cheekbones, a sunburned complexion, and a very bright, keen, dark, and piercing eye. He also describes him as a man of letters and learning. He spoke English perfectly well and read many books, and Sir Walter Scott's poetry appeared to have left a strong impression on his mind. And he adds that Pitchlin appeared to understand correctly all he has read, and whatever fiction had enlisted his sympathy in its belief had done so keenly and earnestly. And finally, Dickens describes Pitchlin as a diplomat. He writes, he had been chiefly at Washington on some negotiations pending between his tribe and the government, which were not settled yet, although he also notes that Pitchlin had no love for Washington. He was tired of towns and cities and longed for the forest and prairie. Perhaps most importantly, Dickens also found in Pitchlin someone who concurred with his low opinion on the U.S. Congress. I asked him what he thought of Congress. He answered, with a smile, that it wanted dignity in an Indian's eyes. So, who was this Peter Pitchlin? Briefly put, by 1842, Peter Pitchlin had become the principal liaison between the Choctaw Nation and the United States government. He was born in 1806 in the Choctaw Nation, in present-day Mississippi, in the community Hushuqua in the northeast of what is now the state of Mississippi. His career as a figure, in Choctaw politics took shape during a period when Choctaw political power moved away from the hereditary chiefs to a younger generation of elite, educated, and often mixed-race men. His father was the Scottish trader John Pitchlin, while his mother, Sophia Folsom, was the daughter of a white man and a Choctaw woman. So Pitchlin belonged to a wealthy family that owned 60 enslaved African Americans in 1831, making them the largest slaveholding nation in the Choctaw Nation. The Pitchlins held a prominent status due to John Pitchlin's role as a trader and also their relation to the district chief of the northeastern district of the Choctaw Nation. Due to all of this, Pitchlin gained prominence in the 1820s as a future tribal leader. He got involved with the drafting of the first Choctaw Constitution in 1826 and 1827, and he helped to lead an expedition into Indian territory in the fall of 1828 to scope out the Choctaw lands west of the Mississippi to determine whether or not they would be adequate for the Choctaws to remove to if they were to sign a removal treaty. After the Choctaws did sign a removal treaty in 1830, Pitchlin took over as a chief of the Northeastern District during the removal process briefly in 1832 to lead his people to the Western lands. So basically, Pitchlin is one of the people. It's unclear whether he signed the removal treaty in 1830, but afterwards he kind of like takes on the role of kind of leading his people west from what is now Mississippi to what is now Oklahoma. And he's one of the first people to actually go, but it's also partly because he wants to be there first. He wants to scope out the best available lands for himself and for his own plantation as well. So as you'll probably guess from this talk, Pitchlin is in many ways a very complex and very fraught figure. In the decades that followed, he engaged in diplomacy with the Chickasaws and the Americans, and by the time he met Charles Dickens on board the General Pike, he was the Choctaw Nation's most seasoned diplomat, frequently traveling back and forth between the Choctaw lands in Indian Territory and Washington, D.C. And this is basically an outline of the removal trek they underwent. But if Charles Dickens understood Pitchlin's status as a diplomat, in American Notes, he was more interested in the Choctaw man as a symbol of the vanishing Native American, the representative of a people that was fading away in the course of history. Dickens wrote, "There were over 20,000 of the Choctaws left," he said, "and their number was decreasing every day. A few of his brother chiefs had been obliged to become civilized and to make themselves acquainted with what the whites knew, for it was their only chance of existence." He dwelt on this and said several times that unless they tried to assimilate themselves to their conquerors, they must be swept away before the strides of civilized society. So for Dickens, the Choctaw diplomat's own clothing carried out the story of either assimilation or vanishing. Dickens wrote, "He was dressed in an ordinary everyday costume, which hung about his fine figure loosely and with indifferent grace. On my telling him that I regretted not to see him in his own attire, he threw up his right arm for a moment, as though he were brandishing some heavy weapon, and answered that his race were losing many things besides their dress, and would soon be seen upon the earth no more. But he wore it at home," he added proudly. What makes Dickens' account so interesting is how he hints at Pitchlynn's status as a diplomat and his career, but he also seems to downplay it as well. By the time that they met on board the steamboat, Pitchlynn was not only a diplomat, but also a plantation owner and a slave owner, something Dickens would probably have abhorred if he knew about it. But to what extent were these roles visible to Dickens? Or did Pitchlynn downplay those roles purposely when he talked to Dickens? The author described Pitchlynn as, quote, "a stately and complete a gentleman of nature's making as I ever beheld," adding that Pitchlynn moved among the people in the boat as another kind of being. So for Dickens, Pitchlynn is an anomaly on board of the steamboat, and the author is somewhat surprised that he is well-versed in literature and dressed in ordinary 19th century fashion. And he is amused by the fact that this Choctaw chief would carry a business card with him. Dickens' description of Pitchlynn is an example of what historian Phil DeLoria calls Indians in unexpected places. His presence on board the steamboat disrupts the cultural expectations about where Native people show up in American life and what they represent. So here's this well-dressed, striking, well-read Choctaw man with a business card. He is certainly out of place in the monotonous crowd of Americans on board the steamboat. His presence on the steamboat makes him an anomaly compared to the reigning representation of Native peoples in the transatlantic culture as well, whether it's the idea of the fierce warrior on horseback, the degraded, drunken Indian, or the idea of the noble savage who is incompatible with the currents of modern life. But if Pitchlynn is an exception to these representations, the fact that Dickens is surprised to see him on board the steamboat also reaffirms those cultural expectations to begin with. So this suggests that by 1842, Dickens understood the world of travel and commerce on the Ohio River as one that was now fully American. It was shaped by what he thought was the monotony of the people, as well as the monotony of the landscape on both sides of the river. His words, not mine. I love the landscape. But Pitchlynn's diplomatic travels along the Ohio River also remind us of a longer history in which the river was a thoroughfare of indigenous diplomacy. And as such, the river played a major part. Oh, pardon me, I'm one slide behind. These were kind of like dominant tropes by which Native people were often thought of, you know, either like the noble savage, the degraded drunken Indian, or the proud warrior on horseback or in the woods. But Pitchlynn's diplomatic travels along the Ohio River remind us of a longer history in which the river was a thoroughfare of Indian diplomacy and played a major part in the social and political life of different Indian nations in the trans-Appalachian West. So in this next part, what I'll do is I'll put on my 7-mile boots and I'll take a few moments to go through some texts that allow us to see this longer history of Indian diplomacy and cultural exchange in the Ohio River Valley. So, flowing from Pittsburgh to Cairo, the Ohio River is the largest tributary of the Mississippi drainage basin. In a recent issue of the journal Ohio Valley History, historian Andrew Frank reminds us that the Ohio Valley was native ground for most of its history. Indigenous peoples of different tribes, nations, and cultures competed for, but collectively controlled the region long before and long after French and English itinerants and settlers arrived in the early 18th century. In that same issue of Ohio Valley History, Elizabeth Mankey explains that the Ohio River links the Great Lakes and St. Lawrence River watershed, the Mississippi watershed, and also connects the Ohio Valley with the Chesapeake Basin, and connects the Gulf of Mexico with the river systems of the American Midwest. So, as she sums up, for centuries, if not millennia, those waterways made the region an important North American transit zone. She adds that in eastern North America, rivers like the Ohio shaped indigenous movements, geopolitics, settlement, and in many instances, identity. The name of the river, too, suggests a history of indigenous exchange. The name Ohio comes from the Seneca word for beautiful or good, but the U.S. Geological Survey also recorded no less than 88 different indigenous names for the river, which underscores the fact that the Ohio Valley had long been a crossroads of different indigenous peoples. This is borne out, too, by archaeological evidence that shows that different groups had settled lands in the Ohio Valley for thousands of years. In the words of Elizabeth Mankey, the country's waterways had, quote, long been conduits for cultural exchange, innovation, and adaptation. Artifacts made from flint from Indiana, copper from around Lake Superior, shells from the Atlantic and Gulf of Mexico, and mica from southern Appalachia offer material evidence of extensive networks of diplomacy and exchange. After the Louisiana Purchase, American explorers grappled with the historical evidence of the Ohio River as a region shaped by such exchanges. An interesting example is the account of an expedition from Pittsburgh to the Rocky Mountains by the explorer and scientist Edwin James, published in 1823. The book, and some of you might be familiar with this book, is based on James's notes of the expedition of Stephen Harriman Long in 1819, which started from Pittsburgh and went as far as present-day Nebraska and Colorado. The expedition was part of a series of expeditions that the U.S. government organized to map the country that had been claimed by the Louisiana Purchase and to map also the Indian nations that they found within the bounds of this territory. And if you're interested in the history of Indian diplomacy and a first-hand account of how Indian diplomacy kind of worked in the West, this is a fascinating book that recounts in detail the interactions, but also the misunderstandings between people in the trans-Mississippi West. And it also has a lot of really, really funny moments that are actually worth checking out. So highly recommend it for your reading. James's description underscores that he and other scientists understood the long history of Indian diplomacy in the Ohio River Valley. An interesting moment is his description of a small island in the Ohio about 23 miles west of the rapids of the Falls of the Ohio. James writes that its name derives from the great numbers of fragments of flints and broken arrow points and various instruments of stone which are found here on turning up the soil. He speculates that this island has probably been the favored residence of some tribe, particularly expert in the manufacture of these rude implements. So he writes that many of the stones he finds are limestone, but he also finds a triangular prism, which was made from an aggregate of feldspar and hornblende, unlike any rock we have seen in the valley of the Mississippi. He describes the prism as about 5 inches long, perforated all the way through to form a tube, and smoothly polished on the outside and the inside. Then James suggests that this tube is very similar to tubes of a very hard stone mentioned by the Jesuit historian Miguel Venegas, which is a book from the late 18th century, and who described similar implements used by native people in California in treating the sick. So James is basically theorizing that these artifacts from California show up in the Ohio River Valley, which suggests like this longer and very thorough routes of exchange that connect the Californias to the Ohio River Valley. James' theory reminds us that 19th century explorers were acutely aware of these larger patterns of cross-continental exchange. As James reflects, that it may have passed by means of the intercourse of the various tribes of Indians from the primitive mountains of California to the rapids of the Ohio is not perhaps improbable. Indirect methods of communication may have conveyed the production of one part of the continent to another, very remote from it. So James was grappling with evidence of an indigenous history that was shaped by cross-continental travel and exchange of goods, information, people. And what I find interesting here is that he uses the word communication to describe the travel of artifacts across space. He adds that those communications were common across other parts of the continent as well. He writes, for example, that a museum in Philadelphia holds many Indian pipes made of red clay, which were found only along the Little Sioux River, a tributary of the Missouri River. One of these, he writes, was found on the banks of the Rio de la Plata in South America, and several were also found in a territory now called New England and in the northeastern part of the continent. So whether or not James's theories hold up, and I think his evidence is a little bit flimsy, I love this passage because it tells us that Edwin James saw native people as cosmopolitans, basically. Despite his use of such fraught terms as savage and primitive, his immediate conclusion hinged on the idea of indigenous people as travelers, as diplomats, as traders, who built this world of cross-cultural connections that stretched across the continent. But if the history of the Ohio River Valley was one of long-standing travel and exchange, it was also a history of depopulation as well. In the 1630s, as smallpox swept across from the Atlantic states to the Great Lakes, raids by the Six Nations, or Haudenosaunee people in present-day New York, raids by the Six Nations people stretched into the region around the headwaters of the Ohio River. And in the 1640s, the Beaver Wars displaced the Wendat people from Ohio country further west to the Great Lakes. And as Elizabeth Mankey writes, this was one of many displacements that reshaped the wider Ohio country, which by 1680 was mostly depopulated. The history of war and displacement, however, did not mean that Native presence was eradicated in the wider Ohio country. But it did determine how this Native presence was shaped. Mankey writes that despite depopulation, the transit corridors of the Ohio Valley continued to be well-traveled, especially by the Haudenosaunee, or Six Nations people. In the Ohio country, the Haudenosaunee continued to be an influence, and further south in the Appalachian Mountains, the Cherokees had withstood the wars and epidemics of the 17th century and expanded into the Ohio River Valley in what is now Kentucky and West Virginia. And by the 1740s, what you see is the emergence of many multi-ethnic resettlement communities, often grouped together as the Ohio Indians. Shawnee, Seneca, Oneida, Wendat, Lenape people all began to form multi-ethnic communities that were dominated politically by particular nations, even as they were home to people from many different tribes. So the 18th century history of the Ohio River is one in which the movements of different Indian nations led to the creation of new communities that on the one hand operated as sovereign polities, but which also defied the cultural coherence of the Indian nations. They were really multi-ethnic communities that were quite new and innovative. The village of Logstown is an important example in this history, and an early reminder of the Ohio River as a thoroughfare of Indian diplomacy. Located directly on the right bank of the Ohio River, the original village was settled by Shawnees probably as early as 1725, less than a mile north of present-day Ambridge, Pennsylvania, which is about 80 miles downriver from Pittsburgh. Around 1747, in an effort to claim the Ohio Valley, the French built about 30 log cabins there, just above the original Logstown village, which they turned over to the native people in the area in an effort to secure their allegiance. Logstown became an important location for trade and diplomacy between indigenous nations, the French, and the British. In 1747, the Six Nations Confederacy sent two headmen to act as emissaries to Logstown, the Seneca chief Tanacrisan and the Oneida chief Scarawati. And in 1749, the governor of New France claimed the Ohio River for the French and sent 300 men down the river to evict the British traders at Logstown and to reassert French dominance in the region. So it's interesting that Logstown on the Ohio River kind of emerges not only as this kind of multi-ethnic community shaped by different indigenous peoples, but also as a really important site of diplomacy right at the moment when the French and the British interests in North America are beginning to really compete, and just before the outbreak of the Seven Years' War in 1754. In 1753, a young major, George Washington, held counsel at Logstown with Tenochrisan and Scarawati as well, which helped to convince the Shawnees and the Lenape to side with the British during the Seven Years' War. The French attacked the British at Fort Necessity, and in June 1754, after Washington surrendered, Scarawati burned down Logstown before the French took it over. By 1758, the native population had abandoned many of their neighboring villages, which meant that Logstown lost its prominence in the region. And by the time George Washington returned to the site of Logstown in 1770, none of its residents were native anymore. Now, all of this might lead us to think that the indigenous presence on the Ohio River Valley was a very fragile one. But the work of Susan Sleeper Smith actually shows us that this is only one side of the story. In this book, Sleeper Smith helps us to understand the Shawnee communities as part of a thriving indigenous economy in the Ohio River Valley. In her book, she writes that by the mid-1700s, luxury goods were a cornerstone of the Indian trade, especially such things as silk cloth and ribbons, brocades, tea, fine china, silverware, and tea services. So what this tells her is that by the mid-1700s, Shawnee communities in the Ohio River Valley and the Ohio country were actually rich. They were economically really stable, they were importing luxury goods, and despite having lost a lot of diplomatic power in the region, they had a lot of rich communities, actually. By the end of the Seven Years' War, the Indian trade in the Midwest expanded for a long period, and cloth items, not fur, began to account for the majority of trade items. In the 18th century, the Indian trade thus extended the older history of exchange in the Ohio River Valley. And at Detroit, which was a hub of what was still called the fur trade, almost three-fourths of the trade goods consisted of cloth that was transported to the Ohio River Valley. Now, this emphasis on luxury goods suggests a degree of economic stability and indeed prosperity for the Ohio Indians, but also that Native women played an important role in Native social and economic life. Native women who can embellish trade cloth emerged as significant people in their households and communities. And through their industry, women advanced an important cultural legacy. It was they who created the clothing style, which you can see here on this slide, that characterized Indian dress in the 18th century Ohio River Valley. These forms of dress were highly symbolic and very culturally specific, even as they also increasingly reflected a sense of multi-ethnic, pan-Indian identity as well. And as Susan Sleeper Smith notes, when you go to Midwestern museums and you see the display of clothing that looks like this, most of them will actually have been made in the Ohio River Valley. And she traces this kind of overlooked history of a really important site of economic production that was all centered on luxury clothing and luxury items. So this history suggests that in spite of a loss of diplomatic power in the wake of the French and Indian War, or the end of Logstown for that matter, Native life in the Ohio River Valley was not merely a story of inevitable indigenous disappearance. In the second half of the 18th century, the wider Ohio country saw a dramatic increase in population numbers, not only because of refugees moving westward, but also because of natural increases among existing Indian populations as well. But this also led to some trouble, too. And Susan Sleeper Smith writes about how in the late 18th century, well-dressed Indians living in prosperous villages were an enticing target for Americans who squatted on Indian lands and who considered Indian people fit objects for plunder. And in 1782, when George Rogers Clark came into Shawnee territory near the Great Miami River and lay waste to five Shawnee villages, this was a turning point in the history of the Ohio River Valley. As the historian Robert Engelberts writes, although the Shawnees' resistance continued, the Americans had struck at the heart of a crucial trade route that was used by indigenous communities. And this marked what he calls a new Shawnee diaspora. So by the end of the 18th century, we kind of see the end point of Indian diplomacy in the Ohio River Valley. This is kind of like the end times of when Indian nations were able to wield a lot of diplomatic power in relation to either the European empires or the United States. As the historian Andrew Frank writes, by the early 19th century, Native American communities remained in the region, but the Ohio Valley ceased to be native ground or a borderlands region. The population of indigenous communities collapsed, outsiders stole or possessed nearly all of their homelands, and Native nations' political sovereignty became subject to the whims of the Supreme Court rather than determined by diplomatic relations. This also means that the history of removal in the Ohio River Valley looks different from, the history of the removal of the southeastern Indian tribes like the Cherokee or the Choctaws. When the United States forced Cherokee removal in the 1830s, for instance, this took the form of removal of thousands of people at once from their homelands in Georgia and Mississippi to Indian Territory in present-day Oklahoma. And in the case of the Choctaw and the Cherokees, for instance, removal happened by treaty and was organized in a series of overland treks. The case of the Shawnees, for instance, speak to a longer and less visible history of removal, one that John P. Bowes explores in his recent book, Land Too Good for Indians. Compared to those large-scale cross-continental removals, removal in the Ohio country was a history of smaller land cessions and more regional displacements that nevertheless added up to an equally profound reconfiguration of native space, if not a nearly complete eradication of Indian nations. Now, after all of that, we might think that in the period after the Revolutionary War, this history of indigenous exchange, of cultural creation, simply ended in the Ohio River Valley. And indeed, the displacement of the Shawnees, for instance, and their military defeat could easily lead to the assumption that this marked the end of the indigenous history of the Ohio River Valley, which was now mostly shaped by white settlement and the extension of U.S. sovereignty. So if we return to Peter Pitchlin and his encounter with Charles Dickens, that would make Pitchlin's presence on the steamboat on the Ohio River indeed an Indian in an unexpected place, an anomaly as a native person in a region that was now defined by the settlements of Euro-Americans and the gradual disappearance of an indigenous presence. Indeed, Dickens suggests that Pitchlin was merely a tragic foil in a larger story of white conquest. He wrote that, "When I told him of that chamber in the British Museum, where they preserve household memorials of a race that ceased to be thousands of years ago, he was very attentive, and it was not hard to see that he had a reference in mind to the gradual fading away of his own people." And according to Dickens, Pitchlin asked him, "What could a few poor Indians do against such well-skilled men of business as the whites?" So I find this interesting. You know, Dickens' commentary suggests that there's a distinction between Americans who are businessmen, who are well-skilled, who are prosperous, versus the poor Indians who lack all of that, basically. Pitchlin, for Dickens, represented a people who were not versed in such skills, and therefore the mere victims of American designs and enterprise. But of course, Pitchlin too was a plantation owner, a slave owner, a diplomat, a politician, a lawyer, a Freemason, a public speaker, a former police officer, and also an educational administrator as well, which I'll talk about in a minute. And him having been a police officer is interesting too. He headed up the first Choctaw tribal police force back in the 1820s. And ever since then, he referred to himself by the title of Colonel, which is funny because Dickens, one thing he complains about a lot in American notes is Americans always kind of bestowing dubious military titles on themselves as well. So I find that kind of ironic too. And of course, you know, Colonel Sanders comes to mind immediately, but you know, I won't go there. So Dickens kind of, you know, sketches this world where Americans do enterprise, Americans do business, and indeed they're too preoccupied with business, whereas Native people, he kind of imagines they're only affected by American business, they're only affected by American enterprise. But anyone familiar with Pitchlynn's story will know that his history challenges Dickens's picture of him. So I would argue that we should see Pitchlynn as someone who extended this older Native history of exchange and innovation in the Ohio River Valley. So one thing that's remarkable about Dickens's account in American Notes is that he did not recognize the important role that Pitchlynn played in promoting institutions of Choctaw education. And indeed, it's strange that American Notes, which is essentially a study of American institutions, courts, prisons, hospitals, asylums, and schools. Even so, Dickens doesn't even mention the fact that Pitchlynn's life and work was intertwined with the history of Choctaw Academy in Scott County, Kentucky, which was the premier institution of Indian education in the first half of the 19th century. And Choctaw Academy, these are the remains of it, if you're familiar with it, is in present-day Georgetown, Kentucky, in Scott County, just above Lexington, if you're a Louisvillian. The story of Choctaw Academy is probably increasingly familiar to folks in Kentucky now. But the school was started in 1825 with funds for education that were stipulated in treaties that the Choctaws had signed with the United States. The first Choctaw students arrived there in November 1825, and the school was intended as an academy for young elite men, quite like Pitchlynn, who they envisioned would be the future leaders of their tribe, lawyers, businessmen, politicians, etc., etc. Choctaw Academy, however, was housed on Great Crossings, the plantation of the Kentucky Senator Richard Mentor Johnson, the later vice president under Martin Van Buren. And in her book, Great Crossings, historian Christina Snyder lays out the fraught history of race and gender that shaped life at the Academy. The operations at Choctaw Academy were managed by Julia Chin, an African-American woman who was Johnson's slave, but also his common-law wife, with whom he had two daughters. The majority of students at Choctaw Academy were Native and came from different places. Besides Choctaws, there were students from the Southern Creek, Chickasaw, and Seminole nations, from the Potawatomis in the Midwest, from the Osages and the Quapaws in the Missouri Valley, and also several Dakotas from the Great Plains. And it's interesting that a number of these nations had all been removed to Indian territory. So one idea behind the school to bring all these students together from different places was to form better relations between Indian nations that were suddenly all kind of stuck together in the same region, some of whom had traditionally been enemies, like the Choctaws and the Osages, suddenly needed to get along now that they were basically neighbors in Indian territory. Pitchlynn himself, too, had been a student at Choctaw Academy in 1827, when it served as a springboard for his political career, which depended in part on an education that was sponsored by the Choctaw General Council and the Indian Office, or the Office of Indian Affairs. with the approval of the Choctaw General Council, back in the 1820s, the Office of Indian Affairs, which managed the relations between the United States government and Indian nations, paid for his expenses by allocating $500 from the Choctaw's educational funds, most of which went to his clothing and books. But Pitchlynn left Choctaw Academy after only 3 months to enroll briefly at Transylvania University and then the University of Nashville, where he attended classes from November 1827 to April 22. Sorry, April 1828. Despite his short stint at Choctaw Academy, he secured a letter of recommendation from Richard Mentor Johnson, who oversaw the Academy, who praised him as, quote, a young man of amiable manners and disposition, whom nature had endowed with great and good qualities. Now, it's tempting to see Choctaw Academy in the same way that Dickens saw Pitchlynn aboard of the General Pike steamboat, as an anomaly in the larger landscape of American education, and as an odd location of indigenous culture in a region where native land title had been effectively extinguished. And it seems kind of odd why the school for the Choctaws in Mississippi and Indian Territory would be located here in Kentucky, right? But with a little imagination, we can see the school as a very typical case of how native influence had always worked in the Ohio River Valley. In the first place, not unlike the villages and towns that emerged in the 18th century, Choctaw Academy was a multi-ethnic community. About a third of the students were white Americans. The other students came from a variety of Indian nations across the United States. And like the Haudenosaunee presence, for instance, in the Ohio River Valley, Choctaw Academy was an instance of Indian diplomacy creating a native presence from tribal nations that were far away. But in more concrete ways, too, the location of Choctaw Academy suggests the important role of the Ohio River as a connection between the eastern seaboard and the Mississippi River. On his diplomatic travels, Pitchlin frequently traveled back and forth between Indian Territory and Washington, D.C. So the Academy's location in Georgetown gave easy access to the Ohio via stagecoaches to Louisville and to Cincinnati. This made the Ohio River a convenient access route not only between Washington and Indian Country, but also to the Superintendency of Indian Affairs in St. Louis, which was headed by William Clark until his death in 1837. The St. Louis field office was an important hub for Indian diplomacy, perhaps an even more central office than the one in Washington. In either case, by traveling back and forth along the Ohio River between Washington and Indian Country, Pitchlin was traversing the roots of ongoing diplomacy between the Choctaw Nation and the United States. So, yeah, on the one hand, it seems kind of odd that Choctaw Academy would be located in Kentucky, far away from Choctaw Nation. On the other hand, if you see the Choctaw Academy as an institution that is created by Indian diplomacy, by treaties negotiated, by money that has to come from Washington, that it has to be kind of managed in relation between the tribe itself and the United States government, but also the superintendency in St. Louis, suddenly the location begins to make a bit more sense. It's kind of conveniently located between Washington and Indian Country, and it seems to kind of make more sense if we kind of see it as an institution of Indian diplomacy as well. Pitchlin's attitudes towards Choctaw Academy radically shifted between 1825, when he championed the school, to 1841, when he became its superintendent. Briefly put, his ideas on what was effective education for Choctaw people changed before and after removal in 1832. By 1841, Pitchlin had sought to dismantle Choctaw Academy wholesale. After he set up in Indian Territory, Pitchlin hammered on the need to build Choctaw institutions there, in their new homelands. In 1842, he wrote an educational act that established an elaborate system of schools in Indian Territory, consisting of 6 academies and boarding schools for male and female students. To this effect, he disenrolled the remaining Choctaw students at the academy in Kentucky in 1841 to establish a new academy in their homelands in the West. And this one would be placed under direct supervision of the Choctaw Council, and like Choctaw Academy, it would become a training ground for the nation's future leaders. But unlike Choctaw Academy, it would be a school just for Choctaw students in the Choctaw Nation. In a number of speeches, Pitchlin argued that the Choctaws needed more direct control over its education. And he made this case to a temperance society, to the General Council, and also to a new lyceum that he started in the Choctaw Nation in Indian Territory. Delivering a statement to the General Council in 1841, he spoke in support of administrative independence of their schools, arguing that, quote, "the prosperity and happiness of mankind is solely dependent upon schools and literary institutions, and that no nation can be prosperous without them." But he also believed that because Choctaw Academy had basically become a pan-Indian institution with lots of white students to boot, the Choctaw students were losing touch with their own language and culture. And he also believed that, quote, "unless you yourself establish your schools, appoint your teachers, and jealously watch over them, you may expect nothing from them but what you have experienced heretofore." He held that there were, quote, "no public funds belonging to the Choctaws, which would be prized more highly than our school funds." a nun which we should watch over with greater care and strictness. So in short, Pixel was getting worried that the American government was getting too meddlesome in Choctaw education, and he wanted to, in a way, renationalize it, make it more of a Choctaw institution rather than a kind of pan-Indian institution. As Pitland saw it, establishing their own academy in the nation would wrest their education away from American control and would secure what he called a broad, free, and independent foundation for their education. Also, he said, it would keep the school secure from the avarice of speculators and the influence of white men. And his suspicion of speculators is kind of interesting. He's afraid that people want to buy more and more Choctaw lands, basically, and use Choctaw Academy as a way to basically cheat the Choctaws out of lands. But it's interesting also that at Choctaw Academy, one class that students took was actually land surveying, because the Choctaws also knew that land speculation and having control over how to manage your own lands was the thing to get wise about, basically. So this means that when Pitchland took on the role of superintendent of Choctaw Academy in the early 1840s, he did so just to enroll all the Choctaw students and take them back to Indian territory. In fact, when he met Dickens on the steamboat going to Louisville, Pitchland was returning home from a diplomatic trip to Washington. And the slide I forgot to show you is the later iteration of the school that Pitchland started in the Choctaw Nation. So when Pitchland met Dickens on the steamboat going to Louisville, Pitchland was returning home from a diplomatic trip to Washington, during which he had lobbied Congress for more financial control over the education of his people. On his way back, he stopped by Choctaw Academy to carry the remaining students with him back to Indian Territory. At this point, Richard Minter Johnson had come to see Pitchland's influence as destructive to the school. In a letter to the U.S. Secretary of State, John Spencer, he asked in vain to keep Choctaw Academy running, believing that Pitchland would, quote, stop at nothing to lessen the school in value. So if 15 years earlier, Johnson had praised Pitchland in his recommendation letter as, quote, a young man of amiable manners and disposition, he now concluded that, quote, he had never met a man so base. But not only did Spencer endorse Pitchland's new academy in Choctaw Nation, it was even named after him in his honor. As one of the six new schools established by the Choctaw Education Act of 1842, the newly established Spencer Academy secured Pitchland's goal of renationalizing Choctaw education on an administrative level. Now, perhaps this explains why Pitchland did not tell Dickens at all about Choctaw Academy. Even though at this point he was the superintendent of the school, Pitchland had actually come to disidentify with its mission, and perhaps because it had been mired in controversies also over students' violent behavior, cockfighting, and tensions between the Indian students and the African slaves that served them. The other thing, too, is Pitchland's own son was enrolled in the school, and his behavior was not, ideal, so he was in frequent conflict with the administrators of the school as well about his own son's behavior. But the story of Choctaw Academy also complicates Dickens' image of Pitchland, in which Pitchland functioned merely as a symbol of those few poor Indians who could do nothing against the well-skilled men of business as the whites. Indeed, the story of Choctaw Academy is one of continued native enterprise and cross-cultural exchange in the Ohio River Valley, and one in which the history of Indian diplomacy was part and parcel of how Native people claimed a social and political place in American society. Nor was Pitchland the only person to do so, and I'll conclude with a little anecdote from another book that gives another example of the ways in which Native enterprise and innovation kept extending into the Ohio River Valley. When he traveled back from Choctaw Academy that last time in 1842, Oh, and I just want to make a little pitch. If you want to read more about Pitchlin's own writings about Choctaw Academy, my book came out this month and has one chapter dedicated to Peter Pitchlin. Now, unfortunately, the book is prized at you know, what would be a really nice dinner for two at a very nice restaurant. It will be out in paperback next year, and there is a discount code as well, which means it's priced at a nice dinner at not so nice of a restaurant, I guess. But, you know, you can take it or leave it. I won't be offended. When you travel back from Choctaw Academy that last time in April 1842, Pitchlin took a stagecoach to Louisville, and from there he got on board a steamboat to Little Rock, Arkansas, that was operated by Joseph Van, a Cherokee entrepreneur. Now, Joseph Van was the son of James Van, chief of the Cherokee Nation during the era of removal. And like Pitchlin, Van belonged to a prominent slave-owning family who were early among their people to remove to Indian territory. In her book, The House on Diamond Hill, historian Taya Miles tells the history of the entwined lives of Cherokees and black slaves on the Van family's plantation before and after the Cherokee Trail of Tears. Now, like Pitchlin, Joseph Van's experience with Indian removal was very much shaped by his economic success and the social position he held among his people. And like it was for Pitchlin, removal did not mean the end of Van's enterprise in the Ohio River Valley. After he set up in Indian Territory, Joseph Van operated several successful businesses. His plantation had extended significantly, and mostly he traded cotton, which he transported himself. And being involved with horse racing in Indian Territory, he also brought a famous racehorse in Memphis named Lucy Walker, whose colts he sold for $500 each. And by the early 1840s, he operated a steamboat, the only one registered in Indian Territory, to transport his cotton to New Orleans, Louisville, and Cincinnati, and which he named Lucy Walker after his prize-winning horse, as you would. Van's story is connected in an interesting way to the history of Indian removal. When the Lucy Walker first set out in March of 1843, its passengers included some 200 Seminole Indians from Florida who were being transported from New Orleans to Fort Gibson in Indian Territory under a U.S. Army charter. They had been captured in Florida by the U.S. Army as part of the federal efforts to remove southern Indian tribes to Indian Territory. And this was part of a longer history as well of the U.S. Army chartering steamboats to actually remove Native nations to Indian Territory. And in fact, when Pitchlin removed in 1832, they chartered a steamboat called the Brandywine, which transported the wealthier Choctaws to what is now Oklahoma. Joseph Van himself met his end on board the Lucy Walker a year later while on the Ohio River. Although accounts differ on the details, the Lucy Walker was carrying some 136 people, including wealthy passengers as well as slaves. And it's interesting that 2 years earlier, there had been a slave revolt of Joseph Van's slaves, and some of the slaves who escaped were killed, and some of them were put to work on the Lucy Walker. The boat famously sank when its boilers blew 4 miles from New Albany, and the boat perished in a matter of minutes. And in The House on Diamond Hill, Taya Miles recounts the various myths and interpretations that swerved around the reasons why the steamboat sank, but it appears that only 30 of the passengers survived, and up to 50 bodies were recovered. Fragments of the boat were later found on the shores of the Ohio, on both the Kentucky and Indiana sides. And the sinking of the Lucy Walker became a defining maritime disaster of the mid-19th century, made headlines in a range of newspapers, and led to new debates over the regulation of American steamboat engines. Now, I would say that Joseph Van's story, too, can be read as an odd tale of a wealthy Native man whose career might seem to be another instance, another footnote in the history of Native North America. But both Pitchlin and Van, I would say, underscore that the indigenous depopulation of the Ohio River Valley was not the end of indigenous history in the Ohio River Valley. The river had always been a place of travel and diaspora, So the schemes of Pichlin and Van extended a longer history of cross-cultural exchange in the Ohio Valley, and even after the Ohio Indians had lost their diplomatic and negotiating power. In other words, the story of the indigenous Ohio River had a longer history than the one in which Native diplomacy simply ended by the 18th century. So how then can we think differently about Peter Pichlin's presence on that steamboat in 1842, as described by Charles Dickens? Was Peter Pichlin an anomaly on board of the Pike steamboat? Should we, like Dickens, think of him as an Indian in an unexpected place? And I think these questions concern the way we think about the relation between Native American history and the place that we inhabit. And I think this is what is interesting about the Ohio River and its indigenous history. So often when we think about the Native history of the place we live in, the question often tends to be, what were our Indians who lived on these lands before, you know, they were settled by white Americans? And those questions are valid, certainly, but they can also diminish our understanding of indigenous history by linking it to very discrete cultural groups that are kind of locked in place. And the indigenous history of the Ohio River Valley is one of displacement and forced removal as well, but it's also a story about indigenous people crisscrossing different regions in pursuit of diplomacy, educational projects, and also business. And this reminds us that Native people have always been part of the creation of the modern world through travel, diplomacy, new technologies, enterprise, and building new institutions. As such, the currents of the Ohio River Valley were a crucial force in the displacement of indigenous people, but also the rebuilding of Indian nations and innovations in indigenous life. By staying afloat on the Ohio River, then, we might just capture more and more of our region's indigenous history. Thank you so much. I am more than happy to take questions, and I'll hear your question and repeat the question back for everyone. And please remind me if I forget to do so. Right, that's a great question. So the question is about Pichlin's racial identity. He was the son of a white trader, a Scottish trader, and a Choctaw woman who had one white parent, basically. So indeed, according to the blood quantum rules, that makes him quarter Choctaw, indeed. Yeah. And it's interesting, especially in relation to the history of Choctaw Academy, where Richard Mentor Johnson, by comparison, his children are born to a white man and an African American woman who had a white parent as well. So Richard Mentor Johnson's children were a quarter black, basically. Under Kentucky law, which was based on Virginia's codes, if you were free, that would mean one quarter of African American blood would mean you were counted as white. But if you were enslaved, you were black. And the interesting thing that happens is, at one point, Richard Mentor Johnson grants his children freedom. Because if they're free, basically their racial identity changes. It works differently in Choctaw Nation, where Peter Pichlin, he spoke Choctaw as his first language. He phenotypically was often described as kind of like a mixed race. He was a quarter Choctaw, but there was never any question about his Choctaw identity. He was very much presented to others as a mixed-race Choctaw, but culturally, linguistically, he was embraced as a Choctaw man, basically. And part of it has to do with the fact that identity in Choctaw Nation was based on matrilineal descent as well. So the fact that his mother was, born in the Choctaw Nation to one Choctaw parent meant that he was kind of, you know, seen as fully Choctaw. So yeah, it's an interesting question, and so and tells us so much about how notions of racial identity were so much in flux in the 19th century. And one thing that is interesting is, and Christina Snyder's book about Choctaw Academy is fascinating in this regard. Richard Minter Johnson had a common law marriage with Julia Chin, who was, you know, legally speaking, his slave. And there was controversy around it, but the controversy was not that he had children with her or that he was married to her. The controversy was that he actually owned up to his family and that he actually embraced them as his children. So yeah, the history of Choctaw Academy is a fascinating example of the way that these notions of racial identity are very much in flux. Oh. Oh, please go ahead. In the Ohio River in particular. You know, this is a cop-out, but it all depends on how we define writing, right? My work is very much about Native American literature written in English, which the history of that can be, I would trace to about, you know, the 1680s when you see the first Native American writers beginning to, you know, adopt, you know, the pen as a writing instrument and writing, in mission schools mostly. If you think about writing in terms of, a broader set of like pictograms, you can probably chase it, you know, centuries and centuries earlier, back into the prehistory, which at which point you would have to talk to an anthropologist to get a better answer. So I would argue that Native American literature is all about, you know, the relation between writing and, you know, oral traditions, basically. And Pitchlin is interesting because he writes a lot, you know, early in his career, in the 1820s, in the 1830s, he's all about Western education. He loves, you know, Paradise Lost. He loves Sir Walter Scott's poetry. He's all about Western-style education. And he says, basically, all that stuff, all those myths and traditions, that is kind of prehistory. We don't need to bother with that anymore. That's superstition. He changes later in life. In the 1870s, the Atlantic Monthly does an interview with him and like writes his long biography of him. And at that point, he begins to reclaim more of those histories. So Pitchlin begins to kind of share Choctaw traditional knowledge much more. Their origin stories from emerging from the earth at the Mother Mound in Mississippi. And I imagine that he's basing that on oral traditions that he learned from his mother's side of the family, which trace back well before the written record. But I find it really interesting that Pitchlin, as someone who kind of promotes Western-style education of Choctaw Nation, is like fully embroiled in it, and then later in life begins to think, hey, with all this emphasis on writing and Western-style education and reading books, I've kind of neglected another kind of legacy as well. But in terms of actual finding the earliest records of that, I would have to call my anthropologist colleagues, unfortunately, but that's a great question. Thank you. Matt?
Yes. I have a couple of questions. Have you read the story of Mary Jameson, you know, that she narrated and was written down in the chapter? Well, I love that story. And then at one point when she's really young, the natives bring her down river on the Ohio, and she has a really happy time along the banks of the Ohio. So I was hoping that was pretty tight. Does anybody know?
You know, that's a great question, and I didn't consider to go back to it, and that would make a lot of sense. She was with the Seneca, if I remember correctly, which So the Seneca influence in the Ohio River Valley is basically the outer reaches of their influences are kind of go past what is now Pittsburgh. And I'm not sure if her narrative takes us into the Kentucky part of the Ohio River Valley, but it's very much possible.
She was pretty far south, and in her story, she gets pretty far south at one point, and then she goes back.
Right.
But it was really beautiful. Another thing, when you were talking about the Ohio River, and you said right bank, so is right bank as you go downstream, or, I mean, how do you know right bank?
Oh, yeah, let's see. At that point, let's see, I can.
You were talking about, I think, the far northern part.
Indeed, yeah, yeah.
The right bank. It was like early in here. I mean, is that just usually how people engage things on a river? Right is on the.
The quotation is from Elizabeth Mankey, who writes a little bit about the history of Logstown in the 18th century. And it might be hard to see. Right there is where the Ohio River turns north a little bit, I suppose. So I guess what I call the right bank would be the northern bank of the Ohio River.
You talked about Native American literature, but what language are they writing in, and how did they translate the language that they were probably spoke to our point of view? Did they write in English?
That's a great question. Yeah, the question is, when you talk about Native American literature, what language is it in, and how was it translated, and how, you know, was it written down? There are many 19th century Native writers who write in English. Pixlin is interesting because he writes both in English and in the Choctaw language as well. When he writes, for instance, what basically became the Choctaw Constitution in the 1820s, it's written in the Choctaw language was only recently translated by scholars at the University of Oklahoma. But the bulk of Pitchlin's writings are all in English. So Pitchlin is an example for someone who did most of his alphabetic writing in English. Now, if we think about the longer history of Native writing, it gets a bit more complicated, where I study a lot the history of Indian diplomacy. And the thing about diplomacy, if you ever watch, you know, United Nations do what they do, it's like incredibly slow work. So basically what you have is usually you have, you know, either a treaty council or a delegation to Washington, or sometimes a gathering just in the Choctaw Nation, for instance, where you have usually, actually the cover of my book is an example of it, you would have different delegates speaking in their own languages. Then a translator repeating it, sometimes in one language, but sometimes in several languages if there were multiple, you know, different tribes whose languages were not mutually intelligible. Then there's usually a scribe who writes it down. And what is interesting about it is that if you read like a lot of the records of Indian diplomacy in the National Archives, like if you go through them and through them, at one point you begin to think, man, these all sound the same. And that's probably intentional. I think Indian diplomacy works by these kind of like scripted routines, like these ceremonial practices, like forms of address that are almost ceremonial. And that's probably also to give the scribe a little bit of a break. You know, they can use a little bit of shorthand, and they can kind of like anticipate, you know, the rhetorical moves that they're making. The answer to your question is there's like a really wide variety of kinds of writings people did in multiple languages. I would say though that the records of Indian diplomacy and Native American speeches and political writings, all of that exists, you know, in English, in the colonial records, There's no original text to compare it to, so yeah, it is very much an English language literature.
Did they use the Roman alphabet?
They did, yes, yes,
when
indeed.
They,
yeah.
Even if they wrote in their own language?
Oh, sorry, no, in their own language, the Cherokee has their own syllabary. The Choctaw Nation, too, has their own script as well. So, yeah, I would not be able to do any translation
well,
myself.
I just remember the story
yeah.
of Sequoia sometimes.
Right, exactly, yeah, yeah, that's a good example. And the adoption of alphabetic literacy in the Cherokee Nation and the Choctaw Nation is rapid and, you know, widespread as well. And, you know, within the span of, you know, 5 years, Cherokee Nation goes from being like a fully oral culture to being one of the most literate communities in the United States as well.
I was very surprised to hear that they were slave owners. I had no idea. That was widespread?
It was widespread in the southeastern nations, indeed. The Choctaws, the Cherokee, the Seminole, the Chickasaw, all had, to varying degrees, but all had forms not just of slavery, but also chattel slavery, plantations. This emerges in the late 18th century when a lot of white Americans, but also European transplants, begin marrying into the tribal nations as well. On the other hand, also, you have folks like Bichlin, folks like Joseph Vann, who really, really see just the economic potential of plantation slavery, and you know are fully on board with you know what that means for them, but also the tribes as a whole. So,
well,
yeah.
Obviously.
Indeed, yeah, yeah, for sure. Yeah.
The Indians have kind of a tradition of enslaving other Indian tribes that they would capture. I mean, slavery wasn't a new.
That's correct, yeah, indeed. Yeah, the question was, was there like a longer standing tradition of raids and capturing among American Indian nations? Yeah, indeed, and those are the two sides of the story. On the one hand, if you look at, you know, the American Southwest, but also the Iroquois people in present day New York, you'll see that there's this long standing, you know, tradition of morning war raids, which is where basically you replenish your own population by going out to raid other nations and bring back captives. The Southwest borderlands, too, are shaped so much by, you know, war parties, raiding people. And the difference, I would say, is often those raids are meant to kind of bring back people in a certain social function within the tribe. So the purpose of like enslavement and capturing people in a lot of traditional societies is not so much to make them work for you, but rather for someone like Mary Jemison, actually, for that person to become a member of your tribe and to replace the social function that you lost because of, you know, diseases perhaps or warfare. So there's two different histories of slavery in Indian country, I think. One is that longer history of raids, captivities, and then the other history, too, of actual chattel economic slavery.
Probably helped improve the gene pool. I mean, seriously.
I noticed in the photograph of this, I think, Spencer School, it was all males.
Oh, right, right.
All males. Were the Choctaw tribe educating the females?
They were, actually, yeah. That's a good question. The question is, the photo of Spencer Academy, which is the later iteration of Choctaw Academy in Indian Territory. I'm too fast. I click too fast. The question was, they're all boys. Are they just educating the boys? Indeed, Spencer Academy was, but Spencer Academy was also part of an educational act that I think established 6 schools in the Choctaw Nation, and they did have women's seminaries as well. So, yes, the Choctaws were not only kind of early to adopt education, they were also extremely innovative in the kinds of education they produced as well. That was all boys, yeah, yeah, yeah. That was, yeah, that school was established, like Spencer Academy, was established with the purpose of educating.